Hello there, it's J. David Weeder here. You can call me Dave, and as you might have suspected, this is not Dave's Daredevil podcast per se. Hear me out for just a moment. I've been fighting a viral infection for a couple of weeks. I had it on the ropes, but it came back and started knocking me down Apollo Creed style. The main thing is, don't feel bad for me. I'm a little rough, but I'm going to be fine. Antibiotics are great. But this is yet another setback in a line of setbacks that have plagued the second half of 2015. There have been 4 weeks without episodes. It's been very frustrating to get episodes out. Some of the editing has been more choppy than I would prefer. And I started looking ahead. Next 2 months, I have some more dental work. We've got, of course, the holiday season, which affects my work as well as personal time with family. And things started looking patchy. It looked like a minefield, so I realized I need a solution. I can pound out a bunch of half-ass episodes, or I can look around at a different alternative. I don't want to go 8 weeks without episodes or start doing these patchy one episode here and there. Luckily, the J. David Weeder archives came through for us, and I saw a great opportunity to put an older series I've done back in play. Sitting on my hard drive is almost every episode of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, which was an X-Men podcast I did with Michael Bailey. As mentioned, Michael Bailey and I started the show together in June of 2011. John M. Wilson joined along the way. This was very much pre-Rachel and Miles Explain the X-Men and oddly concurrent with a show called X Aspirations. And the goal was to cover every X-Men appearance. Very similar to Dave's Daredevil podcast, which put it in contention to be a rerun type show. Now, schedules and life being what it is, quite like it is now, we couldn't balance the show and decided if we couldn't do it right, let's retire the show. And I saw a really great opportunity to represent the show in full. It was a very fun show to do, so that's what you're going to hear over the next 8 weeks, all 8 episodes. And there were originally 9, but one seems to be lost forever. And what that will do is fill in the gap, allow me time to start working on the show and getting lead time back to make sure it's a consistent quality show going forward. Now, I do want to give you a big warning. This is not the usual PG-13 that Dave's Daredevil podcast is. I do have the explicit tag on for these episodes. I definitely want to be clear. I don't want any angry emails. So what this will do is patch us up to the beginning of 2016 when we get back to normal with some included surprises I've been wanting to present to you. And, you know, I make you a solemn promise that anything like this, if there's a gap, I will always make the wait worth your while. So I'll be working on the show in the background and building up those episodes, trying not to be such a screw-up in the future. For now, enjoy Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters.
Welcome. This is Stan Lee of Marvel Comics warning you to look around you, your classmates, your friends. You never know which one of them may be a mutant.
It's a collector's item first episode of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, an X-Men podcast, looking at the X-Men saga from the beginning, with your hosts J. David Weeder and Michael Bailey. This week, we begin the journey through every issue of the X-Men with the rise of Marvel and Stan Lee's creation of the Merry Mutants. And welcome to the premiere episode of Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters, an X-Men podcast. I am one half of your Merry Marvel reading company, J. David Weeder. And joining me on this adventure is podcasting juggernaut Michael Bailey.
Hey, everybody.
And Xavier's Podcast for Gifted Youngsters is a show devoted to covering every issue of the X-Men from the first issue forward. And before we really get into our look at the X-Men, I thought it'd be good to kind of give our backgrounds with the characters, as well as what we plan to do with this podcast. So, Michael, why don't you tell us about your background with the X-Men?
The first time I remember ever seeing the X-Men was on Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends. They had the origin of Firestar-ish episode, I believe it was, where they go back to, Xavier's mansion, and we get to see, you know, Wolverine and Nightcrawler, and I think Colossus. I'm probably completely mixing that up with Pride of the X-Men.
No, they were there.
My comic book knowledge is really, really sketchy up until I'm about 11 years old and really started reading and collecting comics full-time. I had a couple issues of Uncanny X-Men that I got in this big box of comics that I got for the Christmas of 1985, but I never read them. Those were like the two of the books in that pack that I never read. But because I was born in 1976 and because I was, 13, 14, 15 years old, around 89 to 91, as I have said in multiple other places, if you weren't I read the Superman books, and if you read the Superman books in those era, you might as well have been wearing a dress, because the X-Men were king.
Yeah.
They were what everybody else was into. There was a guy in my math class in seventh grade that was showing me issues of the X-Men that he had gotten, because he was completely obsessed with Archangel. And in the summer of 91, the very late summer, I jumped on the bandwagon along with everybody else and started collecting X-Men at Adjective X-Men number one, and I collected the first like four or five issues of X-Force. But I really stuck with that Jim Lee X-Men title for almost 2 years, and really enjoyed the characters, but just fell off after Executioner Song, because I just kind of lost interest. But I really didn't truly become a fan of the X-Men until early 97, when my friend Ryan sold me his comic collection, which mostly consisted of X-Men books. And for the first time, I read through that era of X-Men that I had never read before, because I was only reading the Superman books. And it was just the energy of that era, especially of the Claremont issues, cannot be denied, and it's almost like a force of nature. And I set about filling in the missing issues that he had. I was like, okay, he's sold me these really cheap. I'm going to continue filling in the issues. And since that time period, I off and on will pick the books up and start reading them. I have read Essential X-Men volumes 1 through 4, so basically everything from Giant Size X-Men to just at the very end of the Burn run, and cut to like issue 160, and I've read everything there up to 180, and then starting around 217, everything there from like 309. So I've read a good chunk of X-Men, but there's a lot of gaps in there.
Yeah.
And the era we're going to be covering is one of those gaps. But I really love the characters, though. I love the team. I love the dynamic. I love the ever-changing roster. And even though it's extremely cliche, I'm a big fan of Wolverine. Even though we won't be talking about him for like 4 years. Yeah.
Well, I actually began reading the X-Men at about 14, around the same time, right at the end of the Muir Isle saga, just as the second Adjectiveless X-Men title debuted, and then X-Force and the Peter David X-Factor, followed almost immediately by the animated series. And most of my reading had been in Superman books and the DC Universe, but this was an exciting time to jump on the X-Men. Because the action figures were also released that summer, so it was all just inundated all at once. And while I was reading my Superman books and Archie and Justice League International, it felt in terms of being an outcast among other collectors. I never got to sit at the cool kids' lunch table, essentially. So I jumped on the X brand wagon as well, and I quickly started snatching up all the back issues that I could. And I think I went all the way back to right before they were in the Australian Outback.
Uh-huh.
And I was with Uncanny X-Men and X-Men until about 2005. X-Force, I mean, obviously ended, and I dropped it quite a while before that. But I saw a lot of iterations of the team, and also things like X-Statics and variations, just the different interpretation of Xavier's dream. But I really became fascinated by this era, by the original team of X-Men, Beast, Cyclops, Iceman, Angel, and Marvel Girl during the Executioner Song storyline. There's just a scene where Scott and Jean are sitting at Harry's hideaway talking wistfully about the early days, and that moment it really hit me that the original five literally grew up together. There's a family element, a dynamic to that, and just a huge piece of history between the characters. And for years, I wanted to explore that, but the back issues, they were so costly, and the reprints, mm-hmm. even the masterworks, were pretty expensive themselves.
Yes.
And of course, with the advent of technology and digital comics, the older issues are now available and easy to access. And so finally here was a chance to read the X-Men story from the beginning, and I intended to do it originally, well, to blog about it, but podcasting seemed a better fit for the experience.
Yeah, and I remember when the first X-Men Masterwork, I mean, not Masterwork, Essential X-Men came out, and, you know, I bought it, and it was like $17, but you got like 20 issues worth of books, which I thought was awesome. And I was just fascinated that you could sit there in such an inexpensive format and read 20 issues worth of the history of this these characters. And I'm really glad that they put out those DVDs a couple, like about 5-6 years ago, before that company lost the license and Marvel started their digital online thing, which I'm not a really big fan of. Or at least I wasn't last year when I tried it out for a month when Iron Man 2 came out. You get like a month free through Dr. Pepper or something like that.
Yeah, I found the interface to be awkward, so.
I mean, I like the concept, and I really wouldn't even mind paying a subscription to get access to all of that, because if you really break down the money, it's not all that much to read as many comic books as you want. But those DVDs were just such an easier format to read them in, even though they're not quite as clunky in the PDF format, but they're almost there.
Yeah. Well, luckily,
it's a little weird.
I've been reading, because that's what I've been using to reread these issues, and I took it and emailed it to myself to put it on my iPhone, and in iBooks, it's much easier. It just brings a little bit more of that touch aspect to it, which doesn't sound right, but... So here we are podcasting about the X-Men, and should we address the 800-pound gorilla in the room that both of us come from Superman podcasts?
Yeah. Well, Superman in general, too. You know, I'm a DC kid from way back, but the first comics I ever read really sporadically until 1987 were Marvel. So really, this is an interesting exercise, kind of like when they asked me to be on the Spider-Man Crawlspace podcast. I'm talking about things, characters, and comics that I am not as intimately familiar with as I am with Superman, or if I was doing another DC podcast. So it is kind of interesting that two people that are diehard Superman fans have picked up the X-Men. And I think it's also very funny, because I didn't read your background story in the notes you sent me, because I wanted to just hear it as it happened. I think it's funny that we both were kind of the outcasts of the comic book community when we were younger, because we didn't read those books.
Yeah. Come to school the next day, talk to other fanboys. Hey, did you know Clark proposed to Lois? Really? That's great. Move along, sir.
Getting into an argument with somebody. I vividly remember this conversation. Well, you could pierce Superman's eye. Why could you pierce Superman's eye? Well, it's the only part of him that's not invulnerable. Where are you getting this? This is an actual conversation I had when I was 12, 13 years old in the 7th grade.
Wow.
So,
did you walk away angry from that?
A little, yeah. A lot, but it was a couple months later that he showed me one of the Inferno issues, and that was kind of cool, so I enjoyed it.
Well, actually, one of my best friends and I, when we were in elementary school, we actually were bitter enemies until we started arguing about the Juggernaut and whether or not he was or was not a mutant. And for years, this argument went on until I finally was able to prove he's obviously not. Spoiler.
No, he's got the helmet and the crystal, and that's pretty much his thing, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. For years this went on, so.
Well, you see, it was really different for me, because even though I knew people who collected comics, I didn't really hang out with them like they hung out with each other. Mainly because we didn't read the same books, so I was the geek amongst the geeks. So, I mean, it was a little lonely, but at the same time, I was the only one in school that didn't have to run around like a chicken with my head cut off when Superman number 75 came out, because it was sitting in my hold box. And I remember one of them saying, "Did you get it yet?" I was like, "Yeah, I got it yesterday. It was in my box." What? And see, this was the same jackass that gave me a hard time because I didn't pre-order Youngblood number one earlier that year. So,
oh, did you? Or Super Mario Brothers number one from Valiant? I actually found it. It accidentally went into a 50-cent box, and I'm like, "I'm paying for college." I obviously didn't. but
yeah, it is kind of funny that that of all the people to choose to do an X-Men podcast of this nature, we are the ones that have chosen to do so.
Well, I think part of me likes it because it's so different from Superman.
Oh, very much so, especially this first issue.
Oh, yes.
and these first, because I've read the first six issues years ago, because I picked up Marvel, despite what Marvel said about 2 years ago when they started releasing softcover Masterworks, they did that before. They did it in the 90s. They released a Spider-Man 1, an X-Men 1, an Avengers 1, and I think there was another one. But I, for some reason, I mean, it was only, how much was this thing? It doesn't even have a price on it. That's kind of scary. But it wasn't all that expensive, and it was the first six issues of the series, and since the X-Men were so freaking popular, I thought I might as well see what their origin was. And these are some goofy damn comics. I mean, in a good way, like entertainingly goofy.
And that's something we're going to get into next episode.
Yes, definitely.
So what, kind of to lay out what our plan is with this podcast, quite simply, as we stated, we're going to read and examine every issue beginning with number one and cover dated September 1963. And we're going to be doing one issue per episode, and the episodes will be coming out bi-weekly. And as Michael pointed out, there's going to be over 60-plus episodes until Giant Size X-Men number 1 and Wolverine Storm. So we're going to be dealing with the original class for quite some time with a few additions down the road.
Uh-huh.
But this week, to kind of set it off, we're actually looking at Stan Lee and Jack Kirby and sort of the rise of Marvel, setting the stage for the creation of the X-Men. And to start it off, talking to who doesn't know who Stan Lee is?
I'm sure there are people that don't, but just in case.
Just in case. Stan Lee's actual real name is Stanley Martin Lieber, and he was born on December 28th, 1922, right in the heart of New York City. And growing up, Stan was a voracious reader who really enjoyed writing and graduated high school early. He was 16 and a half. And he graduated in 1939, the year Timely Comics was founded by Martin Goodman. And that would be the company that would become Marvel. And their debut was Marvel Comics number one later that very same year.
If I'm remembering the story correctly, he would enter writing contests. There was like some magazine or newspaper or whatever that would have a writing contest, and he won it several weeks in a row to the point where they asked him to stop submitting.
Yes. And he talked about that in Marvel's Mutants and Monsters.
Yes. Yeah. Which is if you want to see a great interview, get the DVD that David just mentioned. It's Kevin Smith interviewing Stan Lee in a comic shop.
And it's fantastic. It's on Netflix streaming, by the way.
Oh, yes, it is, isn't it?
Yes.
I forgot about that. Yeah, definitely check that out.
Although I did, watching that, find myself wanting to just say, "Shut up, Kevin Smith. Let the man speak."
Well, he wanted Kevin to talk.
Yeah. Well, but it's just Stan's talking, and Kevin's like, uh-huh, yep, uh-huh. And it reminded me of Wayne's World 2.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. Uh-huh.
Work is hard.
Uh-huh.
Wayne's World. But Stan Lee, actually, his uncle Robbie Solomon helped him get a job as an assistant at Timely Comics, which is ironic that I think his chances were good since Martin Goodman, his wife Jean, was Stan Lee's cousin.
apparently he would sit up on the filing cabinet playing the ocarina. He was like this goofy little kid.
Yeah, and he started out just sort of being a page.
Mm-hmm.
And then through some fluke of fate, well...
They needed a text piece in an issue of Captain America.
Yeah.
And that, I think that was his first writing for Marvel.
It was just a fill-in, and next thing you know, he was writing comics. He never intended to stay with comics.
No, he wanted to write the great American novel.
Yeah.
Was what he wanted to do.
And meanwhile, at Timely, there was one Jacob Kurtzberg who was using the pen name Jack Kirby. Kurtzberg was a little bit older. He was born in August of 1917, also in New York City, in a rough area. So he was a fighter. And I've heard stories about Jack Kirby that...
One of my favorites is from writer Gerard Jones, who was very prolific in the 90s, especially the early 90s, where he was writing like 16 titles at DC. He said he met Jack Kirby, and they were talking about the craft, and Jack just looked at him and goes, "Have you ever been punched in the face?"
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, that must have been such a random question. But the intent was... I think was to, on Kirby's part, is because, you know, he fought every day, apparently.
Yeah, he said fighting just became a way of life.
So here's a guy, the best story I ever read was from Geeks, Gangsters, and the Birth of the Comic Book, where some very shady type came to, I think it was Will Eisner's studio.
Yes, it was.
And was basically trying to muscle them into taking a bad deal. And here comes Jack Kirby, who's probably about as tall as I am, at about 5'5". He's just like, "Is this guy giving you a hard time? You want me to beat him up?" Yeah. It's just like, wow!
And the guy turns and leaves, and they never see him again.
Exactly. And it was just... I am not like one of the people that is completely obsessed with Kirby. I have nothing but respect for Jack Kirby and some of his artwork, especially in the issue we're going to be covering next week, but mainly in like the FF and his Captain America work and all that. You can't really touch him in terms of pure dynamic is the word that always comes to mind when I think of Jack Kirby. All the pages, they pop. Jimmy Palmiotti in this special on comics that was on like the Discovery Channel in 1998, he described Kirby perfectly. He goes, "He did this," and he put his hand towards the camera so that the camera focused on his hand and kind of blurred out the face, and that's it. He made comics three-dimensional.
Yeah.
In a way that no other artist really had. So, I love Jack Kirby. I really do.
And I agree, and Jack Kirby's Captain America is my favorite Captain America depiction. Hands
even
down.
The 70s one.
Yeah.
Even the 70s one is awesome. Well, goofy as hell, but awesome.
Well, I mean, he was a comic book packager, writing and drawing for a packager, and did his first comic book was for Wild Boy magazine, which is ironic. I didn't catch this when I was doing the research. Wild Boy magazine makes me immediately think of Commandy.
Mm-hmm.
But he moved on to comic book publisher Fox Feature, and with that he started exploring the superhero side of things with Blue Beetle, using a pseudonym of Charles Nicholas, which is a house name. And he began actually collaborating with Joe Simon, and after leaving Fox and going to Timely Comics, they created Captain America together. And what's odd is that he did the original Captain America. First appearance. His art, you can watch the evolution of his art style from, because that was prior to him going off to war.
Yeah, and his Captain America, it's a lot thinner than he would become known for in terms of the figure work. You know, it wasn't these blocky mountain of human beings. You know, Cap was kind of lithe and springy, like a runner or a gymnast mainly.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that brought a more youthful style to it,
mm-hmm.
in terms of
very
what we saw
so.
There. But Kirby was actually very touchy when asked about if he changed his pen name due to his Jewish heritage. And Stan, obviously Stan Lee was a pen name. He actually intended to use his real name for later literary works, supposedly. But I think if we're being honest, this was a time in the 40s especially where there wasn't a lot of tolerance.
No, and Timely had a lot of issues after they released Captain America with getting death threats and people kind of picketing outside of the offices and all that, simply because it was, you know, fighting Nazis was not a popular stance before December 7th, 1941. If you think that, you know, the debate we are having now and we were having before 2003 is anything new in this country, you're wrong, basically, because there was a lot of people who were isolationists. But Kirby was very proud of being Jewish, and a lot of the people who created the industry were Jewish. So it makes sense that something like Captain America would pop out to fight the force that was personified of wanting to they didn't know about the concentration camps at that point, but it was pretty clear that Hitler didn't like them.
Yeah, so there was a hint.
But I forget why he chose Jack Kirby, but he used like 14 different pseudonyms.
Jack Kirby, he liked it because it sounded like James Cagney.
Yeah.
But yeah, 13 or 14 was pretty – that's a pretty mild number because I don't know how many he actually went through.
Yeah, he a lot of guys burned through pseudonyms in that era because there wasn't a lot of people doing it. So and to create the illusion that there was this large studio of different artists, you know, they all had different pen names and stuff. And after he left Timely, he went to DC and created – with Joe Simon, they created the Newsboy Legion, which was kind of very similar to the Boy Commandos. But he also reinvigorated the Sandman and did all these other things. And it's really funny to see the time that they were apart. You know, Stan Lee kept on trucking with the Timely, which became Atlas.
Yeah.
And Kirby worked for some independence. He created Fighting American with Joe Simon. Have you ever seen any of those Fighting American
books? I have not, no.
Those are some goofy. They did the first issue completely straight, and then it became a satire of the Red Scare, basically. They came up with the goofiest concepts and goofiest enemies that you could think of. And he created the Challengers of the Unknown over at DC, which is a group I've never really felt anything for.
Same here.
But he finally came back and was doing monster work for Stan Lee in the late 50s, you know, creating like Org, the creature that dresses like a man or something like that. They were all very random. It didn't seem that Stan was putting a lot into the work because he was very burned out at that point. I mean, these guys lived through the Scare and the Comics Code, and the fact that they were still trucking along is kind of amazing when you really think about what they stuck through. Because I think for Kirby, I don't think he knew anything else to do.
No,
but be an artist.
And at that time, I'm glad you brought up the Scare, the Wortham thing, because we're dealing with a time when superheroes were really just starting to come out of sort of a catatonic phase, for lack of, I can't think of the correct term there, but a dead phase, really.
Yeah, because 1951 was when the All-Star Comics turned to All-Star Western.
Yeah.
And it was 5 years. Now, that doesn't sound like very long right now when we consider that Infinite Crisis was 5 years ago. So it doesn't seem that long ago now, but then it was an entire generation of kids before Showcase number 4 and The Flash. And DC started slowly rolling out, you know, the Silver Age of comics, because as much as I like Fantastic Four number 1, the Silver Age of comics began with Showcase number 4.
See, I'll actually go toe-to-toe and say Fantastic. It began, yes, but I think Fantastic Four number 1 defined it.
I will agree with that, too. I think it cemented it more than anything.
Yeah, okay.
It was just like, okay, DC got the ball rolling, and then Stan Lee, through no planning of his own, really, because it's not like any of this was calculated. You know, he and Jack Kirby create the Fantastic Four. I don't really want to get into the debate of who created what, really, because it just seems like kind of a useless argument at this point.
Well, the funny thing is, I mean, the superhero was just making a comeback. They were doing, like, Millie the Model before that, and Kid Colt Outlaw, Linda Carter, Student Nurse. That was in 1961, and Stan was so burned out. He's like, and Goodman comes to him and says, I want superheroes. And Stan's like, okay, I'm on my way out anyway. I'm going to get fired. I'm going to pitch a superhero team the way I want to, and that ended up being the Fantastic Four. And suddenly Goodman loves it, and it hits. And so he was 40 years old at this point. He was ready to move on. So I think it's ironic that he and a later influential X-Men writer kind of entered comics with the intention of just being there for a while until they moved on and then stayed. But Fantastic Four, his way, which will become the Marvel way, I mean, how would you describe it? It's just flawed heroes.
He emphasized a personality rather than a power. As much as I love Barry Allen and I love Hal Jordan as characters, they're kind of, they themselves at that time were kind of boring. There wasn't a whole lot there. The only way DC had Marvel beat in the 60s is that DC women actually had real jobs, whereas Marvel women were secretaries and nurses and subordinate, whereas Jean Loring was a lawyer and Carol Ferris owned an aircraft company and Iris West was a photographer and Lois Lane was a reporter. But the key to Marvel was to take the conventions of superheroes and turn them on their head, which has now become cliched, but at the time it wasn't at all. With the Fantastic Four, you had four characters that were on the same team but were constantly arguing with each other. You know, and Ben would throw a hissy fit because he felt like he was a monster, and Johnny would throw a hissy fit because because he was a teenager and Reed didn't trust anybody else on the team. If you read those first 10 issues, whenever somebody like walked out in a huff, Reed's initial reaction was, well, I hope they don't turn on us because I don't know if we can beat them.
Pretty much.
That's where you're going first? Not, oh my God, my friend just left?
And it would be down the road, but he was probably the worst husband I've ever seen.
He did kind of suck at times, didn't he?
I mean, but he actually, the Fantastic Four hit, and it starts this string of heroes that are, it turns the paradigm on its ear because DC was looked at as sort of perfect and untouchable. They don't have flaws.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes Hulk, who is his entire superhero persona is a giant flaw.
Well, it's kind of funny to read those initial Marvel releases, because at the time they were still being distributed by the same people that put out DC. So their competition was distributing their comics, and it limited the number of books they could do. And they were afraid of doing superheroes because that's what DC was doing. So the first three issues of the Fantastic Four, they're not in costume. The Incredible Hulk number one reads very much like a monster book. He's not really heroic all that much in the book. If you really read it, I mean, it's Bruce Banner that actually turns out to be the hero at the end of that first issue.
Yeah, and the Hulk's, would you even classify him as an anti-hero or just a mimic?
Not at that time. Okay. He was kind of a force of nature, and it was later that he started doing heroic things, but it always seemed kind of ancillary to him just being pissed at the world. And Amazing Fantasy number 15 is a Twilight Zone episode. No, it really is.
No, I know. I totally agree. But here we have this string of heroes, because you have Hulk, Fantastic Four, Thor had just appeared. So we've got a mm-hmm. Norse god on our, you know, in the pantheon.
And his outfit was, didn't exactly scream superhero at first.
No.
It was just, and he really didn't look like the Thor of Norse myth anyways, but still.
Well, but that kind of brings us to the X-Men, where we've had this string of successes, and suddenly, you know, Goodman's like, we need another superhero team or individual. And Stan Lee, by his own admission, and I do have a clip, admits at this point he's just gotten lazy.
Again, as I mentioned, when you do superheroes, you have to say how they get their power.
Right.
Well, I was bored with cosmic rays and gamma rays and radioactivity, and I was running out of things. And I figured, what if they're just mutants?
Right.
I don't have to explain anything. We know there are mutants in the world. There are mutant vegetables, mutant trees, frogs. Okay, they're born mutants. That gets me off the hook. I can then do whatever I want. So it was done, really. It was a cop-out.
I don't... Basically, he doesn't want to create an origin. He just wants them to have powers and be done.
I love this. I love it so much. So he's a mutant.
Yeah.
That's all you need to know.
Well, what is a mutant? I actually have the definition here for the Merriam-Webster. A mutant is an individual, organism, or new genetic character arising or resulting from mutation. Okay. So let's look at the definition of mutation. And at the act or process of being altered or changed. Wait a minute. So if I get bitten by a radioactive spider, isn't my DNA changing so that I can stick to walls?
Yes.
Okay.
Other people have brought up this argument, so I'm by no means claiming it as my own. But really, when you break down the Marvel Universe, it makes absolutely no sense that the Avengers are heralded as heroes and the X-Men are feared and loathed.
Correct.
When they both... You know, the dynamic of the team itself is different. For the longest time, you know, the Avengers were the varsity kids. They were the ones that were on the team, and they went to the pep rallies and stuff. And the X-Men were the artsy kids that you know, were painters and in the theater department and all that, and kind of shied away from the public spotlight.
They were the emo kids.
I hate that term, but yeah, okay. I'll agree with that. You know, it's like, while Captain America and Hawkeye and everybody are rah, 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 you know, Scott Summers and crew are behind the bleachers sneaking a smoke. So it doesn't make any sense. And when you were defining mutation, suddenly I heard Patrick Stewart's voice from the first X-Men film.
Every few generations, evolution skips forward. That was a horrible paraphrase.
But, you know, as a concept, it's really quite groundbreaking when you think about it. Because what Stanley basically said, yeah, he did it out of laziness. But what he was basically put forward is that humankind was evolving before our eyes. And that is kind of a scary concept, you know, because are we the ones that are going to be left behind? And, you know... I think while the argument holds that the Avengers should be feared as much as the X-Men, I think the idea that Captain America was given his abilities and, you know, Spider-Man had the, you know, the public doesn't know this, but, you know, he was, his abilities were external. Whereas with the X-Men, it's just like, oh my God, suddenly at 13, I can split into 16 different versions of myself. That is kind of a frightening concept. I'm not saying that I would be afraid of it, but I can't say that I wouldn't be either, because I've never actually had to deal with the situation.
And we're also dealing, I mean, when the books came out in 1963, we're dealing with, assassination of Jack Kennedy hadn't happened yet, but we're doing a time... where the space race has really started to kick into overdrive, and it would be six years before we would actually land on the moon, but there were missions that were taking place at that time.
Yes.
And we had seen the Cuban Missile Crisis as well.
Yeah.
So the nuclear threat was actually hanging over everybody's head.
And people like to kind of poke fun at everything involved radiation. Well, I would argue you could argue the same thing now with everything coming from, like, genetic manipulation or, in the 90s, cyborgs.
Cyborgs. That was pretty much the comic equivalent to a MacGuffin every in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it was scary. I mean, you're about a year younger than me.
Yeah.
We caught the tail end of the nuclear crisis.
Yeah, I remember
it. I was scared to freaking death when I was like 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years old.
Yeah, and it didn't go away until we were, very early teenage years.
I vividly remember when the Soviet Union fell, and I had the first sigh of relief in my young life. Where it's like, oh, I don't have to worry about being obliterated in a nuclear holocaust.
Go ahead.
And I was about to say, and it's kind of scarier it's not scarier, but it's kind of scarier because people really didn't understand how nuclear weapons worked in the 50s and 60s. You know, the idea of what radiation can actually do was mostly kept from the public to the point where they told everyone to get under a desk. You know, just hide behind that brick wall and you'll be fine. And because the government knew that if people knew exactly what would happen, that there would be complete and utter pandemonium. So
basically, you're going to be obliterated.
Good luck.
Yeah. And if you do survive, you'll probably die of radiation sickness, in which limbs will basically fall off of you.
Stomach will become liquefied.
Yeah.
Your hair will fall out. You know, just the worst parts of the day after.
Well, I mean, what do you think made the X-Men different? Because as a franchise, and it would be quite some time, because it didn't take off immediately by any stretch. But as a franchise, the X-Men became huge.
Really, in reading these first couple of issues, there isn't much of a difference between the X-Men and the rest of the Marvel Universe at the time. They were just presented as the new superheroes. You know, especially in the issue we're going to be covering next week, you know, they show up and we're like, we're the X-Men, we're going to take care of this. And the government's like, go ahead, good luck. And it was only later when Stan Lee realized, and I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. When you look at Stan Lee's writing today, it can be considered incredibly cliched, but at the time it was groundbreaking, and when you think about it, him wanting to talk about racism with an allegory of mutants is actually, that's something that is to be respected and admired. Because when you look at Xavier and Magneto, you had Martin Luther King and Malcolm X.
Absolutely.
You know, two people working for a similar cause under completely different circumstances. And knowing that that was kind of the thought process, I think that's what separates it. I mean, the Avengers was fun superhero stuff. You know, you had a lot of good characterization, even an android can cry, etc. The Hulk, when Stan Lee finally figured out what he wanted to do with the character, after 6 issues of the regular series, and then once it hit Tales to Astonish, it's like, oh, okay, here's an idea, and he ran with it. But the Hulk was very much, he was an outsider, he was a hero that no one understood, and love those stories as much as I do, the Hulk was the most soap opera-ish Marvel book outside of Spider-Man.
Oh, easily. Easily.
And Spider-Man was the hero that could be you. He was the hero. He was a young kid and he represented youth and all that. The X-Men represented like a fear of the unknown. And they didn't take off. And you ask the question, what separates the X-Men from the other Marvel characters? They didn't take off.
No, not at all.
It was the first misstep, really, when you think about it. And the fact that, you know, we're getting ahead of ourselves, but what I know of X history is that they were thinking of canceling it around the time Roy Thomas and Neil Adams started to work on it. And then even after that, it was a couple issues later that it went into reprints. Bi-monthly reprints in the original title. This was unheard of at the time. And it was only until 1974 when the idea really was to create an international team of superheroes so that you could sell it in other countries. And that just accidentally turned into the most popular comic book franchise of the late 70s, the 80s, and the 90s. Everything about the X-Men is a mistake.
Yes. It should. It's a paradox.
I mean, and that is why I think it's such an amazing property that Marvel. A lot of people, I've heard other podcasts that cover more modern comics talking about the X-Men, and it seems like 180 degrees south of what I would want to read about in the X-Books.
Yeah.
You know? And that's not a bad thing. They're doing what they do. I don't think the X-Men have the oomph that they used to. It's really kind of scary that we now live in a world where the Avengers is the ultimate Marvel property, where when you and I were teenagers, the Avengers were the granddad team. And I'm not saying that I agree with it. It was just the common perception at the time.
No, that's absolutely accurate at the time.
Like, you know, the most popular Avengers book of the 90s was New Warriors. And they weren't officially Avengers, but it seemed like that was more popular than what was going on in Avengers and Avengers West Coast.
That's because the New Warriors took the same paradigm that the X-Men were using.
Yes, they did. They were a team of young heroes with superpowers.
But the thing about the X-Men is, I've always viewed, I mean, the era we're going to get into going forward, the original class, or first class as it's called, I've always viewed that as almost like Star Trek, the original series, and then post Giant Size X-Men number one as Star Trek, the Next Generation.
That's a really great way to look at it.
There are fans of both. There are people that prefer them, you know, one over the other, and then there's people that are fans of the franchise as a whole. And I happen to be a fan of the franchise as a whole up until about 2005, when, in my opinion, things kind of started going off the rails.
So you don't have a Claremont versus Libdell hatred?
No, I do not.
Okay. You're one of the few I've ever talked to. I feel like this is fairly interesting to me.
Well, I actually liked Lobdell at the time.
The reason why my X collection stops at around 309 is that's when my friend Ryan got sick of everything and stopped reading the books.
See, I actually left for a little bit at 315.
Okay.
Because
did you come back for Age of Apocalypse?
Yeah. Okay. You called it.
Sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder there. I just figured that would be the best time to come back.
Well, it's logical. It was about a year, and that would be about right. They brought an event out that brought me back.
That was so huge, too. Oh, my God.
And it still stands up. It still stands up completely.
Yeah, I thought about buying the trades, but I've decided just to get the books and to read them in chronological order and just go like that, like how they were released, basically, instead of reading, like, you know, the one miniseries and then the other miniseries and then the other miniseries. And I figured I'd get a better feel of the whole world if I read them all at once, basically.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to doing that at some point.
About the time we retire.
Well, I'll probably read it before then.
Oh, yeah.
There's a difference between, you know, David, I know this is going to sound weird, but we don't have to wait to podcast about something before we read it.
I'm sorry. It's ingrained in me now.
Isn't it? Isn't that the funniest thing?
I'd really like to read that Legion of Superheroes issue, but I'm not slated to do that for quite some time. It's almost like a guilty pleasure when I read my pull list that isn't a Superman book.
It's funny. That's great.
But, I mean, it actually brings something up, though. I mean, we're looking right now at the beginning of this, looking down the pike at 40 or 50 years of X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts before we begin it? Any particular storylines you're looking forward to, or X-Men character that you look forward to exploring?
I am... You know, it's really kind of funny. I don't have anything in particular. I'm really looking forward to watching this era unfold and see the introduction of characters like Banshee and Havoc and all of them, because it's really not a Silver Age Marvel book that is held up as, you know, like, you know, John Cusack holding the tape, you know, the boom box and Say Anything. I mean, it's really almost, for a lot of people, the X-Men didn't start till Giant Size X-Men number one, despite the fact that there were several team changes, there were several, you know, people dropped out, people died, you know, Mimic. There's something I'm looking forward to.
A character I really know nothing about.
Exactly. And it's just, I know it's not considered to be the best of the writing on Stan Lee's part, but I'm really looking forward to getting into Roy Thomas.
I agree.
And his era, just because it's gonna be overwritten, but I at the same time I think it's gonna be really entertaining. And I'm looking forward, more than anything, I guess, you know, I'm just looking forward to learning about this era of the X-Men and watching it unfold issue by issue by issue. Instead of reading it, instead of, you know, like buying all three of the essentials and reading them in a several month period or a several week period, or if I'm really bored, like in a day, which I don't think you could really do because it's Silver Age books and it takes you at least 20 to 25 minutes to read an issue if you're lucky.
If you're lucky, yeah.
But just to kind of see it and like get to the end of an issue and look forward to the next one, because I know I won't be reading it until the next week, basically. And we're doing this bi-weekly, so it's even more of a wait. And I think that's going to be a great way to read it and to learn about it.
And I'm kind of the same way. I mean, I really was thinking about it before we sat down to record and just thinking about everything that's going to come. And we're right at the very beginning. I mean, technically with this episode, we haven't even started. Next episode, we're going to start looking at the issue by issue.
Uh-huh.
And we're just looking down this long pathway of all this history that came before, this legacy that you and I came to know in the 90s, when there was so much already in that history.
Uh-huh.
And just finding out how it actually happened, because there's been so many retcons and and it doesn't take long to start those either.
When I reread that first issue last night before I went to bed, and Professor Xavier said something, I'm like, wow, right out of the gate, that's a big retcon.
Well, there's two of them, Professor and Jean, but mm-hmm. We'll save that for next week.
Yes.
So this is Xavier's podcast for Gifted Youngsters, an X-Men podcast. And anything you want to add this week?
No, I'm just looking forward to getting into it, and I'm kind of glad we took an episode out to just talk about what we're going to do and, you know, our history with the characters and everything.
Yeah, just wanted to set the stage. And, well, join us in 2 weeks when we cover X-Men number one. And as Michael pointed out, the beginning of the lies.
Professor Xavier is a dirty, dirty liar.
And sometime in 2005, we're going to find out through Joss Whedon that apparently Professor X is a jerk. And I'm going to pose this question.
I would actually argue it was before that, but
was it before that? Well, yeah, but this.
No, Mark Waid gave an interview right before he took over the X titles in like 95. That, you know, if you really look at it, Xavier's kind of scary.
And I have tons of notes on that for next episode. But that will wrap us up. I am J. David Weider,
and I am Michael Bailey,
and this has been Xavier's podcast for Gifted Youngsters.
X-Men have won, but only for now. Magneto is still out there, waiting, planning, plotting the destruction of the human race. But whatever the challenge, whatever the peril, the X-Men will be there.